haired weirdos, short haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is political scientist Matt Grossman, director of Michigan State University's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research. He also has this great Twitter feed. I love it. It's just full of interesting, relevant, and most importantly, I think, really substantive things about politics and policy research. It's one of the first tweets that I check every day. And so if you're at all interested in public policy, definitely follow Matt on Twitter. And today, Matt and I are going to be talking about his book, Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. Matt Grossman, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So now, Artists of the Possible is essentially about how American public policy happens. And of course, a lot of people have theories about this, and I've taught plenty of the theories over the years. But what I think makes your book especially valuable is you go well beyond theory. I mean, you actually take a look at what's really a staggering amount of policy history, 790 specific policy enactments and over 1,300 actors that have significant involvement in those policies. That's just, it's overwhelming for me just to think about that amount of research. But I was hoping that to start, you could talk a little bit about kind of what you looked at, you know, the types of policies, as well as that time period that you examined.
Sure. So I looked across all domestic policy areas, so from energy to health to education to everything. And what I did was rely on policy area histories that had been written by other scholars and observers in each of these individual issue areas, and tried to find every policy enactment that they thought was a significant change across whatever scope they looked at. And I included anything from 1945 to 2004. And so that list includes all the well-known policy areas like the Civil Rights Act and the Clean Air Act. But it also includes quite a few others that maybe didn't get as much attention at the time, but were considered influential policies. And it also includes some executive and court actions that were also considered policy changes on par with legislation by the policy historians.
Now, when you talk about significant policy enactments, I guess that by necessity, that's something of a subjective judgment, right? There's not really kind of a bright line sort of designation between significant and more kind of a trivial policy.
It's not completely a bright line, but we did code the policies on a sort of a 3-point scale of small, medium, and large to be easy. And there was quite a bit of agreement across the authors on sort of which ones were the biggest and which ones were the smallest.
Right. And you mentioned specifically that you focus on domestic policy, and I'm assuming that there was a pretty good reason for not including things like trade and defense policy and those sort of things. Can you talk a little bit about why you didn't include that also in your analysis?
Well, it's mainly a distinction based on what scholarship was available. Foreign policy is usually studied in the international relations subfield, and the policy histories that cover it are usually more international in scope or less focused on the domestic politics surrounding the foreign policy enactments. But we did look at foreign influence on domestic policy, and there were a decent number of instances where factors outside of the United States were deemed influential in domestic policy.
Right. And you mentioned this is you mentioned you started in 1945. Was there anything particular about 1945 that you chose? I mean, or as your starting point, or why that period, I guess?
Well, of course, it's the post-World War II era, but it also sort of coincides when most of the policy histories that are out there started tracking things. It also is kind of the beginning of the era of separate issue areas. A lot of the histories that track, say, the New Deal or before tend to just be about everything at once, whereas you start to get this literature that looks more in-depth at, say, energy policy or health policy over an extended period, starting in 1945. And I think part of that reflects that there really were these separate communities of actors involved in each of these policy areas.
And so then did the research available also kind of become more, I don't want to maybe use the word professionalized, but kind of more sort of, I guess, social scientifically rigorous at that point, as opposed to previous areas, would you think?
Well, I think historians find it easier to research more recent events, sure. Often, although usually not kind of the ones that just happened. So there was kind of a stopping point on the other side where there really wasn't much analysis of things at the time I was writing of things in the Obama administration or the Bush administration. So kind of cut it off at some point. But when you get about 10 or 15 years, then you start to get comprehensive histories about what happened and why.
And so can you talk a little bit about how you took all of those policy histories, and there was just a ton of material. How do you go about sort of synthesizing, finding patterns in all of that? I mean, obviously that's a pretty big question. Maybe you can just kind of give the overview of that.
Well, the big move was to accept the historians' judgments. So I didn't individually fact check what everyone said or try to evaluate every explanation that historians gave. I sort of tracked it. I did compare them against each other. I did look to see if it mattered what kind of author I was reading or when they were writing. But mostly I took their word for what policies were important, who was involved in passing them, what environmental factors mattered. And then where possible, I tried to compare the record from those policy historians with kind of independent evidence, things like public opinion or party change, to see if it could predict their assessments of important policies.
So I guess between kind of letting the peer review process do its job and also sort of inter-rater reliability, I guess you could say that you could actually come up with a pretty consistent list of things then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was a fairly consistent list, although there are some differences in the kinds of policies that were mentioned by more of the policy historians, and I was able to look at that. It tends to be just the bigger and more salient policies.
Like I said, it seems like it must have been a daunting project to undertake. But before we get to your findings, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the main theories of how policy change happens. And of course, in your book, you lay things out by explaining what these theories are before you kind of come to your own conclusions based on all of this research. And the first of these theories is agenda setting theory. And according to agenda setting theory, how should we expect public policy to happen, to be enacted?
Well, the ideal type, I think, would be that public and policymaker attention are focused on a particular problem in need of a solution, usually because of some kind of either focusing event like an oil spill or upsurge in media attention, something that gets us all kind of focused on the same issue area at the same time, and that's kind of the first step to policymaking.
And of course, that's for anyone who teaches public policy, and I'm one of those people, that's a fundamental thing that we cover in our classes. And I've told students for a lot of years that that's how things work, at least in part. And so I gotta wonder, how well does agenda setting theory actually hold up in the real world based on your research?
Well, the quintessential kind of agenda-driven policymaking is pretty rare. That is, events, public opinion, and media all matter in some cases, but they matter a lot less often than just internal factors within government. And I also find that there's no general relationship between whether the public and media are paying attention to an issue area and whether we are likely to pass policy to address that issue area. So I think listeners will know things like gun control, which come up repeatedly in the media and in public attention. And they have at some times been associated with real policy changes like in the 1960s. But there is no kind of general relationship between when we're paying attention to it and when something is able to pass, because the disagreement is about what the policy should be, not whether there should be any policy to address it.
Right. And after you cover agenda setting theory, you talk about macro politics. And at least as I understand it, there are a couple of elements that kind of work together, but we can also talk about separately to this. And the first one being that, well, you know, if you have more liberals in office or even in the electorate, you'll get more liberal policy. And to me, all this is outside of the scope of what you covered in the book. The Affordable Care Act would be a great example of this, because there are lots of people who would say the only way you get Obamacare is because, you know, Democrats are in charge of the executive branch, have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, and that's basically a major factor in how it came about. Is that more or less how it works, at least in theory?
Yeah, so the view would be we get more liberal policy when Democrats win elections and liberals are elected, as in 2009.
And so what about that? I mean, is that pretty much hold true over a lot of policy? And I should point out, and I didn't mention this about agenda setting theory, but I'm sure that you can always find isolated instances, can cherry pick policies where that happens. And so what we're really talking about here is how any of these theories in general explain policy change, right?
Oh, yes. There are instances of each, like Obamacare that you mentioned, being consistent with this theory, and, you know, the gun control or the environmental legislation following an oil spill being consistent with the agenda setting theory. It's just that they're not the sort of most frequent explanations for policy change. In terms of this theory, there is a relationship, but it's nowhere near as strong as people think, and it's sort of completely overwhelmed by a major period effect that I find from 1961 to 1976, where we had lots of liberal policy regardless of public opinion or the party of the president. So if you needed sort of one variable to define whether we were passing a lot of liberal policy during this period, the best one would just be, was it in the 60s and early 70s?
Yeah.
Rather than how much power did Democrats have. So of course Democrats did have a lot of power in Congress during that period, so I don't want to say that it was unimportant, but that's just more important than the sort of ebbs and flows of Democratic gains.
Because I mean, to me, and I think probably to a lot of people on the left, that is sort of almost a baseline or an expectation of how the process should work. And I look to, you know, the long Great Society period, or even before that, you know, the FDR administrations as sort of, well, this is what we should expect. And anything that's not like this is sort of a deviation from that norm of good policy and good government. But that's really kind of more the exception than the rule, right?
It certainly is the exception, and it's kind of consistent with a lot of that. We have this problem pretty regularly in political science, where we assume that, you know, something that when we started paying a lot of attention to the data in the 60s or so was the norm, when it really could have been an outlier.
And kind of along with that, again, with macro politics, is that the idea that public opinion, at least to a certain extent, should drive policy. And that to me is more. It kind of goes right to the heart of what we think of in terms of what we expect in terms of democratic outcomes. If a lot of people are sort of for something, we should expect it to happen. But in reality, it doesn't really quite work out that way, right?
Yeah, at the federal level over this period, I don't find much of a relationship, especially after accounting for that strong period effect during the 60s and early 70s. In fact, the more common pattern is actually the opposite, that public opinion moves against the direction of policy. So it's actually more common that when we pass policy, the public moves in the other direction, like moving conservative under Obama and moving liberal under Trump, what we call that thermostatic public opinion. So the public reacting to policy is actually more common than the policy reacting to the public. But I should say that there are some findings of public influence. For example, I'm now looking at the state level where there's a more consistent relationship between public opinion and policy in the states at least recently. So don't want to say that this never matters, but over this period, it wasn't the most important thing driving policy change.
Do you think maybe that happens more at the state level, and when we get down to lower levels, maybe even more, because you have an electorate that's sort of more similar, and when you have less diversity, you're going to have more of a likelihood of that happening?
It could be. I think the particular pattern in the states, though, was just that, we had some kind of misaligned states between politics and policy, and they sort of became aligned such that, you sort of have liberals and Democrats in states that are more liberal and have more liberal policy now than in the past.
Well, I'm going to try to find a way to kind of bring the public influence in here, maybe, but what about this idea that, okay, so the public doesn't influence policy directly, but it can have sort of an indirect limiting effect? Because if I'm, if I'm a member of Congress and I think, well, there's no way my constituents will go for this, so it won't even reach the agenda. And I know that might be, in a sense, impossible to test, because I'm basically talking about policy that we don't see considered. But what do you think about that as at least a mechanism for some public role in this?
Well, it could be, but I actually think the more important factor is just that there's just a lot of stuff considered in Congress and the executive branch that doesn't really reach public salience, right? That doesn't seem to stimulate much public interest. But I do think that the kind of overall policy that we get is in some ways responsive to public opinion. So in my later work, for example, I find that American public opinion is consistently conservative in kind of general values, but liberal in specific policies, which is kind of a long running finding. And that is consistent with the kinds of policy we get. So we tend to solve problems brought up by liberals, but we do it more through conservative means than other countries. So we use more markets, more federalism, more contractors. We use the tax code over spending. And all of those are in some ways kind of responsive to the symbolically conservative American electorate.
Right. And now, you also talk about issue typology theories, which essentially say that kind of if you know what type of policy we're talking about, you can make some reasonable predictions about whether it can happen or not. And of course, there are a lot of ways you can typologize policies, but one that I'd like to talk about a little bit, and in part because, again, I use it in class all the time, is that fourfold typology, where you look at how concentrated or diffuse the costs and the benefits are. And basically, what I always tell students is, well, when you have a policy that has concentrated costs and diffuse benefits, there's a good chance it's not going to happen. But if you can spread those costs out and concentrate those benefits, then you're going to have a group of people pushing for it and a lot of other people who don't care. So enactment's going to be a lot more likely. And it certainly seems reasonable. And I'm wondering if that one holds up very well.
Well, I think these can be useful in analyzing particular policy debates, but they're not useful in thinking about kind of overall issue area differences, like distinguishing between health or agriculture as a policy area. It just sort of doesn't line up consistently enough to be a good guide to that. The other kind of relevant finding, I think, is that lots of policies tend to be about concentrated benefits and costs. So you just see a lot more interest group politics than those other kinds of forms. And even when you get something like that might have a diffuse cost or benefits, it tends to be fought over in Congress and the executive branch as a thousand little battles over pieces of it, which still have concentrated benefits and costs. So I think it's kind of a useful way to potentially think about it, but it doesn't line up with kind of issue area differences. And I think we underestimate how much of policymaking is just this kind of insider game about specific entities that are going to gain or lose.
Yeah, I wonder if in a way that's almost such a kind of a generalized truism that it doesn't really help us a whole lot when we get into specific things, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's could be useful in the previous point you were making about thinking about kind of why we never get to have certain kinds of policy debates, why certain things are kind of left off the agenda is kind of to get them anywhere close to passage. They tend to end up being pretty complicated and pretty responsive to lots of different particularities and interests.
Yeah. And then the final theory that you talk about kind of, they're all sort of groupings of theories with various, you know, specific models, but this actor success theory, that idea that we get policy because at certain times we have these very skilled, influential, charismatic leaders. And of course here, I naturally think of people like, you know, liberal icons like LBJ and FDR. And I guess conservatives might think about Ronald Reagan, right? That they just kind of push these things through essentially. And do you think we overestimate the importance of these specific individuals? And usually they seem to be presidents, certainly. Or is there kind of something to this theory?
Well, I don't think we overestimate the influence of the president necessarily. The president is the single most commonly influential factor mentioned in policy histories. You know, it's a large portion of the, you know, of the sort of credited individuals are presidents at the time. And some presidents even get credit for policies that pass after they leave office. I also make an argument that having four consecutive presidents from Kennedy to Ford that all had extensive congressional experience may have mattered to that period in the 1960s and 1970s. So I don't want to kind of, you know, eliminate these influences, but the point I'm trying to make is that often we'll kind of limit the analysis to the perspective of one actor. Most oftenly it's the president, but you also see this in interest group studies or studies of research or social movements where they asked, you know, which movements or which research influenced policy or which, president succeeded the most. And all those theories kind of know that, well, they're just dealing with one actor, so they have to figure out how to control for everything else in the process. But I think it when you read these policy histories, you just realize from the beginning, these are all multi-causal processes that mean that if you're looking at it from the perspective of any one actor, it's likely to be deceiving.
Right, right. And the one thing that you mentioned, I want to come back to a little bit, is you said that one factor that was you thought was potentially important is that we had these four presidents who had congressional experience. Now, I've been thinking a lot about presidential candidates lately, understandably so. There seem to be, I don't know, at least a couple dozen at this point. But one of the things that I've always focused on is, well, does somebody have experience as a governor? And I'm like a lot of folks, my argument is, well, if you're used to, you know, running an executive branch, that sort of thing, even though it's a poor substitute. But I'm wondering if you think that in terms of policy success, that maybe having experience actually in Congress with the legislative process at the national level is perhaps more important than being a governor of even a large state.
Well, I don't want to evaluate it as kind of a performance metric because it could be that, you know, the governors are better administrators. But sure. Yes, in terms of passing policy through Congress, I think it does help. And I think in particular, what happened in the spirit of the 1960s and 70s is that, you know, it really was this insider process where everyone knew each other and they knew each other for a long time. And the presidents came into office with already strong ties with key members of Congress and interest groups that were active at the time. And so it just wasn't as hard to kind of build coalitions from scratch. Then you get Jimmy Carter in 1976, who was, who had experience, but not experience dealing with Congress and not ties to these kind of national interest groups and members of Congress. And I think that really showed in his ability to get things through Congress. And most of the presidents since then have not had a lot of congressional experience, the exceptions being H.W. and Obama.
Yeah. And so I guess it's not enough to just have a really good congressional liaison or anything like that. It's that the president himself who actually needs that sort of understanding and have developed those networks essentially over time.
Yeah, and this sometimes gets oversold as, Obama didn't have or Trump didn't have the members of Congress over for dinner enough or things like that. But, in some ways, that is cheapening the process of the development of those ties. And obviously, if we're thinking about somebody like Lyndon Johnson, these are extremely long ties where we're regularly trying to make agreements with people who disagree with us or who care about different things. And so he had kind of established the credibility and the skills to do that.
Right. And so it's not really personal friendships. It's more like understanding pressure points and leverage and things like that with individual members of Congress or people who are in those influential positions.
Yeah, of course, Johnson is most famous for vote counting ability.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, that's a very particularized legislative skill.
Yeah, absolutely. So once you discuss the problems with all of these theories and kind of as a general rule, we can say that none of them do a particularly good job of explaining policy change kind of at that highest level. Then you talk about sort of your own theory of policymaking. And there are a number of things about that I think are really interesting. One of them is your conclusion that the clearest characteristic of policy is what you call pervasive status quo bias. So can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and what accounts for it?
It just means if you want to bet well in Washington, you should bet on nothing happening. It's always easier to block things than pass things. That is due to some sort of classic problems of people being invested in the current system, but it's also due to the many blocks put into our institutions to make it hard to pass policy, and those are effective at doing so.
Right. And some people would actually say, especially on the right, I would imagine, would say, well, that's not a bug, that's a feature.
Absolutely. And there is a reason for that. The most of the time when we pass policy, it tends to expand the scope of government responsibility. And so it's sort of natural that conservatives, while they may complain that they're not getting their policies through, they're more happy with less happening than liberals are.
Yeah. And so that gets to your point, their conclusion that this status quo bias is what you call ideologically asymmetric, that it favors the left on a regular basis, right?
Well, I mean, you could. It depends. It depends how you interpret it. Both sides are right. Right. The status quo bias regularly stops liberals from passing new things that they want to pass. On the other hand, when things do pass, they tend to be liberal. So the norm is kind of for incremental liberal advancement over time, and that is really quite true across the world. It's especially hard to take away prior legislative benefits in any political system. It's in some sense a broader pattern, but it was sort of especially true of this state building that we have been doing in America since the 60s.
Right, since every policy creates a constituency, as the saying has it, it makes it a lot tougher. And so basically, while it's difficult to get that sucker in the door, if you can actually get it passed, then when government does stuff, it tends to, well, of course, increase the size of government, which liberals tend to like and conservatives don't. I guess really the only real exceptions to that would be kind of deregulatory policies and tax cuts and things like that.
There are conservative policies that do pass. They're actually less common in the administration, according to my data, than in Congress. So it's sort of not the case that you usually get deregulation in the administration. But of course, you can get conservative policies everywhere. They're just less common than liberal policies.
So then, and I'm sure some of the conservative listeners will take away from this, we'll see the system essentially is stacked against us, basically.
Absolutely. And I think, there's a reason that you see more proposals for making it easier to pass things by liberals. And you sort of see more complaints about stasis and polarization on the left. It's because they win more from a system where it's easier to pass things.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you also talk a lot about the insularity of policy, and I was hoping you could talk about two things, really, the kind of explaining what you mean by policy is insular for the most part, and also whether or not you think that's a significant problem.
Well, it means that, you know, the factors that matter most for policymaking are usually kind of internal to government institutions. They're about specific people and organizations reaching agreement on policy details. We mostly notice policy when it's kind of high salience and in the media, but the policy change that does get done tends to not always be publicly salient and to be due to kind of negotiations among policymakers and relevant groups rather than kind of these public partisan fights. And part of the sort of corollary of that is if it kind of becomes this big politicized public fight, that's often a sign that it's not going to pass.
Right. Yeah.
Not always, but you know, that can be a good sign that it's going nowhere. Whereas if it's kind of being going on behind the scenes, technical, requires deal making, doesn't have clear sides, then you might be more likely to see actual policy change happening. In terms of the normative effect of that, I do think in some sense it's anti-democratic to say that, you know, things that get done tend to be those that kind of are behind the scenes or are mostly among the interested parties. On the other hand, the system was set up to try to force deal making among various interests, and it does do that.
I mean, and of course when we hear anti-democratic, it sounds almost to everyone like a pejorative. And I think you can make the case, right, that the public actually is not in a very good position for the most part to make some of these judgments, especially about more technical sort of things, you know, whether it's I think about the tax code or regulation of financial institutions or something like that, and that's actually, again, not a bug but a positive feature of our policy system, the insularity that's built into it in a way.
That certainly is an argument that's commonly made. I do think that one of my findings is kind of hard to reconcile with that, which is that policymakers aren't even responsive to the issue areas where the public wants them to address it. So I think it'd be one thing if the public determined kind of what problems to solve and the technocrats determined how to solve them. But that isn't really what we see either. The technocrats are responding to their own motivations rather than those of the public.
Gotcha. So you talk also kind of, this is, I think, gets to the heart of your theory of policymaking, is something you call the institutionalized policy entrepreneur. And can you explain what that is and how you sort of see the role of this institutionalized policy entrepreneur in driving policy change when it does happen?
So I took this concept of a policy entrepreneur, which is someone who works for a long time to get a policy designed and then also to build the political coalition to pass it. But I noticed that some of the quintessential examples from previous work tended to be kind of people from outside of government who are policy specialists. And that's not what I found at the federal level. It tends to be generalists and definitely not outsiders. It tends to be very long-serving politicians or interest group leaders who are often serial policy entrepreneurs, people like Ted Kennedy, who are regularly interested in the details of policy and in knowing the political coalitions possible to to get that done. And I did notice an attitude that is not very common anymore, which is that policy entrepreneurs tend to, these institutionalized policy entrepreneurs tend to look out and they say, of the things that have a chance to pass, which one do I like?
Right.
And they work on those. And we're much more likely now to say, you know, how can I get the things that I most want to pass? And that tends not to be an attitude that is associated with success quite as often.
You know, in mentioning that, you talk at one point in the book, and I forget where, but about you kind of pose the question, who are the modern versions of these kind of older, you know, older school policy entrepreneurs? And you mentioned, I think, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell as, you know, I'm not saying that they are, but can they sort of rise to this occasion? And I got to say, I certainly wouldn't think of those two names, obviously, but is there, in looking out at Congress, I mean, is there anyone you see who kind of fits that mold of kind of a Ted Kennedy or some of those other folks who you could reasonably classify as a policy entrepreneur?
Well, of course, we're having you know, this debate in the presidential campaign season, and it is sort of a debate ongoing. I think there's cases you can build. For example, Amy Klobuchar came out as being the, by the classic legislative effectiveness measures, the most effective senator. Joe Biden, of course, was involved in three different, very different budget deals with Mitch McConnell and the Obama administration. So, it's not there. There's nobody of the same type that I found historically, but I think there are cases to be made that some people tend to have that kind of attitude more than others.
Yeah. It seems to me, maybe it's because it seems like half the Democrats in the Senate are running for president that we don't see a lot of that. I don't know. But you know, when I listen to a lot of the Democratic presidential candidates talking about their policy plans, really, regardless of area, almost always the first thing I think is, how can you possibly expect to do this? You know, given the fact that I think it's fairly safe to say that we're not going to see a kind of an Obama 2009 situation with, you know, control of both branches and the filibuster proof majority in the Senate. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. And if you do, if you think it's kind of, in a way, almost irresponsible of people, and, you know, Elizabeth Warren, I'm talking to you here, I guess, a little bit, and Bernie Sanders, too, to talk about these big things that I just don't see any realistic way are going to happen. And I got to think that Sanders and Warren and some others have to know that, right?
I think they do. I think you know, there's quite a lot of pie in the sky plans that would have trouble, if not be impossible, to pass on the campaign trail. But I would also look at the actual sort of top 10 bills in the House, for example. Five of them are going to pass right away, you know, with universal Democratic support, and none of them seem like they might not ever pass the Senate under a Democratic president.
Right.
So I think there are, you know, that there are proposals out there that have some chance of passing. I do think that there's also an argument that, you know, you should just say what what policy you favor in the primary, and that, you know, that
Sure. People
will notice that, you know, things get whittled down, but you should at least sort of say what you believe is optimal policy.
Yeah, was it the Cuomo quote about you govern in you campaign in poetry and govern in prose or something along those lines?
Yes.
I think. You know, I wanted to ask you about a couple of other kind of, I guess, broad theories of how the policy environment, I guess, has changed over time, and I think you might be sort of uniquely positioned to talk about these given how you had to immerse yourself in policy history. One person whose work I really respect and I've had on the show a couple of times is Jacob Hacker. And I'm sure you're familiar with his work. And basically, one thing he argues is that there's been a pretty obvious, just general rightward move in domestic policy, especially if you look at the areas of, you know, labor, economic, regulatory policy, dating from roughly the late 1970s, really up until today. And I'm wondering, from what you've seen in the policy histories, does that seem like a reasonable conclusion to come to?
Well, it's certainly true that our extensive period of policy liberalism ended in 1976. You know, not passing as much liberal policy is clearly a conservative move, but it wasn't due to a large number of conservative policies passing. It was kind of due to fewer liberal policies more often. Now, Hacker is usually clear about policy drift, that some of what he's talking about is not passing policy. So, the minimum wage being the classic example, of a policy that obviously gets less effective over time due to not acting. Yeah. So I think it's reasonable for liberals to look out and say, you know, look, there's been a conservative move because we are acting less often to solve new problems as they arise or to update prior policies. But I don't think we should necessarily say conservatives have kind of gotten their way. We've really seen more stasis than that.
So, I mean, conservatives could say, well, actually, that was just that long Great Society aberration, and we're just kind of reverting back to the more of a normal kind of centrist norm. So it's not really the case.
Yeah, they might say that, but you do see a real disconnect between what conservatives usually say about their preferences and then what they're actually able to do in office. So you still hear a lot more rhetoric about rolling back the state and regulations and things like that than they're actually able to accomplish.
Yeah, and certainly I've seen in George W. Bush, I mean, there were a couple of pretty extensive policy changes, and I think those were probably just captured in toward the tail end of your research there.
They were, and it's actually the norm for even Republican presidents to propose these expansions of government responsibility, like education and health, to go along with his tax cuts. So Trump is actually really unique in not forwarding any kind of new liberal policies through Congress.
I guess because people like stuff and they prefer not to pay for it, essentially, which is, talk about truisms. But another kind of broader theory about how American politics, especially in the policy arena, has changed that I've talked about a number of times on the show is has to do with Norm Ornstein, who I've had on a few times. And his argument, it seems to me, is that starting in the mid-90s, we see the rise of Gingrich and the Republican Party transforming into what he and Tom Mann call insurgent outliers, and basically that the entire field moved to the right because the Republicans moved further right on policy than Democrats moved to the left. And I'm wondering if that's more of a rhetorical move or we actually see that reflected in policy. What do you think?
Well, so for starters, Newt came to Congress in 1978, mm-hmm. and it perfectly aligns with the Republican Party's steady move rightward by our basic measures of congressional voting. We actually argue that part of that was actually kind of a response to the liberal reforms in the mid-70s. The kind of curiosity here is that it was liberals who kind of wanted to reform the process right at the tail end of their most successful period. But it seems to have ended up by kind of empowering parties over committees, ended up empowering the minority party to sort of be more obstructionist. In terms of how we should consider that move right, it's absolutely the case by congressional voting models, the Republican Party has moved further rightward than the Democratic Party has moved leftward, and the Democratic Party's move is mostly a regional end to Southern conservatives rather than moved by everyone. But I do think that those votes are mostly about whether we should expand the scope of government. So you still have to keep in mind that from Republicans' perspective, they would say, well, if we're only trying to repeal half the Affordable Care Act, then we're not as far right as we were before the Affordable Care Act. Right. So, by some standards, that is true. Liberals still prefer half to none. But by historical standards, it's quite a move to now want to take away a legislative benefit several years after it was legislated. So it really does represent a rightward move by Republicans.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about not just the Affordable Care Act, but it seems to me that at least in the last few years, when I think about significant policy changes, there are really three that stand head and shoulders above all the others. And that's, of course, you know, the Affordable Care Act, the Dodd-Frank financial reform, and most recently, the Republican tax cuts. And I'm wondering, are you able to sort of look at those through the lens of the policy entrepreneur theory and kind of identify, you know, which kind of entrepreneurs drove each of those?
Well, first, I'd say historians are likely to recognize a lot more major policy changes. Sure. And we tend to notice the ones that are kind of the most partisan at the time.
Right.
And so just to mention two others, there was a massive student loan reform that was passed at the very same time as the Affordable Care Act that got less attention but had huge effects. And we just passed a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill that will be seen as a major turn in criminal justice policy. So I think part of the problem is we kind of notice these big partisan fights. But recent data shows that, you know, there's been no increase in parties' ability to pass their agenda, and that most laws still pass with bipartisan majorities. We just kind of hear about them less often. Yeah, in terms of the procedures that brought them about, I think the ACA is going to be one of those, like the Civil Rights Act, where almost every factor that is on my list will be mentioned by some policy historians, because obviously it was this very, very close set of votes, a lot of historical contingencies. I think importantly for our current discussions, it certainly is an example of the Obama administration trying to work with all of the potential objectors in the interest group community and among legislators to try to find some kind of, you know, internal politics solution. On the other hand, it was also a very public debate, obviously, that was discussed in the campaigns as well.
Yeah. Now, I've been thinking a lot, just because I'm one of those sort of frustrated liberals, I guess, who would like to see more policy change. And maybe it's probably my background as an institutionalist. So when I think about problems with getting policy through, I think about institutional structure a lot. And more specifically, I've been thinking about, well, what sort of things could we possibly do without actually having to amend the Constitution, which is, you know, essentially impossible these days. And there are a number of kind of ideas I keep on coming back to. And the simplest, I think, would be ending the Senate filibuster. And I'm wondering, do you think that would have an appreciable effect on policymaking?
I think that it would, but I also think that we tend to overemphasize or overestimate the effects of reforms, especially on passing more policy. We tend to get these kind of deluges of policy more after kind of big electoral changes than after big institutional changes. And I think part of the problem is that we look out and we see, you know, a whole bunch of messaging bills right now that are passing. And we assume, well, all of those would become laws if we could just get over this filibuster. But as we saw, for example, with the repeal of the ACA, even if members of Congress had voted for something for 50 times, that doesn't mean that they were actually willing to kind of carry it out when it actually was likely to become law.
Some that's a little more strategically done, certainly. But I guess in one area, though, and this is maybe a little bit off, but, you know, certainly we see the effect of removing the filibuster for all judicial nominees and how President Trump's been able to, with McConnell's help, push through an awful lot of nominees very quickly. And that would obviously indirectly affect policy in a pretty big way.
Yes. On the other hand, you know, most judicial nominees used to go through without much trouble.
Yeah.
And so in some
back
ways, the barrier was removed was really only in effect for a short amount of time.
Right. Not too long ago, I was listening to an interview with Pete Buttigieg, who's one of my early favorites. I don't know, I like him a lot, but I guess I'm just on that bandwagon right now. But one of the things he was arguing is that Republicans know that their policies can't win in what you might say is a fair fight. And so basically what they're trying to do is to stack the deck by, you know, gerrymandering and working to suppress the vote, basically. But and that when he said that, I was like, yeah, that's right. You tell him, Pete. But then I read your research and I thought, you know, if you're right about the insular nature of policymaking, maybe minimizing gerrymandering and making it easier to vote, expanding the electorate, maybe that's not going to have as much of a difference as I think and as Pete Buttigieg thinks. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, anything that keeps, you know, Democrats in power longer is likely to make a difference. It might also have other effects. So we tend to go back and forth. When we have a Democratic president, it tends to make a Republican Congress more likely and vice versa. So yeah. It's unclear if that would be stable over the long term. But it's absolutely true that Republicans, you know, tend to stack the deck more in the in congressional voting in terms of getting more seats than votes more than Democrats do lately. Although that, you know, it's actually a somewhat short term pattern. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, it was the opposite. It was Democrats who had the bigger advantage. I think it would, you know, it potentially make a difference. But you know, it wouldn't necessarily lead to the policy deluge that some might expect. I also take a more comparative perspective on it, which is just that you know, conservative parties everywhere globally for a very long time have been less enamored with democratizing reforms than liberal parties, and that's for you know, that's for a good reason.
Yeah. Let me throw a much more radical proposal at you. I don't know. I've kind of latched down to this a little bit, but the size of the House, you know, a lot of people may not realize this, but up until the early part of the 20th century, really, we had pretty regular increases in the size of the House to the point where, you know, up to 435. But I'm wondering if we enlarged the House and Congress could just do that on its own to the point where it was big enough where congressional districts were small enough that candidates could potentially run kind of real sort of grassroots door-to-door campaigns, not have to rely on a lot of big outside money. If that might make a difference. I mean, certainly logistically we could have a much bigger Congress, but or House, but would there be any point from a policy perspective, do you think?
It's not obvious to me that it would make a big policy difference. We do have a lot of variation in the size of state houses and senates, for example, and I'm not sure that's real predictive of policy differences across states. Obviously, it would, you know, would have a more direct advantage in representation of more people knowing their member and feeling better represented. So it's possible that's important in and of itself.
Donald Trump, rhetoric aside, tweets aside, how would you rate him as a policy entrepreneur? And I guess, to be fair, we'd probably have to compare him to the last couple of presidents in kind of a similar environment. But how would you say he stacks up in terms of strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I think he's been pretty awful at legislative influence. You know, there's almost nothing that you can credit to Trump. And even though you can credit some things to congressional leaders, and of course he oversaw a not very productive Congress and is overseeing another one. So I wouldn't credit him much there. But in the executive branch, he's actually been there's been a lot more action, and some of it I think is fair to credit to especially how steadfast he has been on immigration and trade, two issues where he has held, you know, fairly consistent positions and really not taken no for an answer from the executive branch. And that is pretty rare, and could be considered, I guess, a sort of a success of policy entrepreneurship.
Now, some, especially on the right, would say, well, that's just kind of a continuation of a trend we started to see with President Obama, basically trying to legislate through executive fiat, as they might say. And so it's not that Trump is doing anything new. He's just picking up where Obama left off.
Well, there's definitely a long-term trend there. But one thing that Trump is benefiting from is he's picked these two policy areas where he does have a lot of power. Yeah. So, you know, if he was really concerned about education and healthcare, he couldn't make as much as many moves. But he's really concerned about trade, where he has a whole bunch of unilateral power, and immigration, where, you know, he's the main enforcement authority. So, yes, there are continuations of trade of trends, but these are areas where he could be quite powerful.
Yeah. And, you know, throughout the course of our conversation, what I'm basically hearing again and again is, well, you know, you shouldn't expect much, and people don't have a whole lot of influence. And that's, you know, that's kind of a bummer, actually, to a lot of folks, I would imagine. And so let me ask you maybe the hardest question to end on is there anything you think we could potentially do that might help, you know, what gets enacted into policy better reflect what a majority of Americans actually want?
Well, one problem is that the public is conflicted on policy. So, you know, as we discussed, sure, they tend to give us these liberal answers when we ask about specific policy questions, but conservative answers on broader ideas about the role of government. And then they also tend to react against the direction of policy. So when we get, even though they might have said we want national health care, once it's enacted, they go against it. Right. Even though they might have said they wanted a tax cut, once it's enacted, they go against it. And so I guess it's not that clear that they're not getting what they want. The typical kind of American solution has been this incremental liberalism that tried to kind of mollify conservatives through the form of policy. So we tended to get policy to address liberal goals through conservative means. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a attempt to address the public's mixed opinions. But I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party's current role makes even that kind of slow advance of liberalism much more difficult. So, you know, I think liberals are asking, you know, whether anything might make a difference to make it move more quickly, especially in areas like climate change, where there's kind of a ticking clock. So I think those are fair questions. The only and some of the solutions that you mentioned, you know, could make a difference. The one caution I would give is that the history of liberal reforms as a project to advance liberal policy is a failure. We enacted all of these reforms of things, everything from campaign finance to party nominations to congressional committees, all right before the era of big policy liberalism ended. So while that's not entirely causal, I think it should be a cautionary note that reforms are necessarily the way to advance policy liberalism.
So on one hand, I guess the negative view, at least again, coming at this from the left, is that, well, maybe we shouldn't tinker with the system because we're going to end up perhaps certainly with some unintended consequences and not with success that we would hope for, at least based on past history. But the positive, or at least if you're a conservative, the negative is it does seem like in the larger, longer sweep of policy history that we're getting more liberal, more progressive over time, just maybe not quick enough for a lot of folks on the left.
Yeah, and so both sides have sort of a complaint that has some basis in reality. Democrats can complain that we're really not doing much, and despite rising problems and policies from the past that need to be updated, and Republicans can complain that they never sort of seem to win this overall battle about the size and role of government.
Well, yeah, I about that, you know, I think of that. I think it was an old motto for National Review. Maybe they stand athwart history, yelling stop. And I guess in the end, maybe that would be kind of a dispiriting sort of position for real conservatives to be in, because it seems like ultimately, based on what we know, they're just kind of fighting a losing battle, essentially.
Yeah, and I think actually this is actually fairly well known and remarked upon in conservative circles, yeah. and also applies to social issues. So sometimes we think about this as a size of government indicator, but over the long term, there's certainly been a shift leftward on social issues, with abortion being the primary exception that's sort of led to stasis. And so, you know, it is fair for conservatives to ask whether they're kind of just slowing their kind of inevitable moves left in government.
All right. Well, on that sort of hopeful note for liberals and depressing note for conservatives, I guess we'll wrap things up. Matt Grossman, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you today.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. We hope you liked what you heard. Listener support is what keeps the show going, and we truly appreciate it. When you become a monthly sustaining supporter of the show on Patreon, you get not only our gratitude, but a supporters exclusive bonus episode each week. And supporters at various levels can get additional bonuses like Politics Guys gear and access to a special supporters only Facebook group. To learn more, go to patreon.com/politicsguys or visit the support page on our website, politicsguys.com/support. Subscribing to the show also really helps, as does sharing episodes, which is easy to do right there in your podcast app. Word of mouth really is the best advertising, and we greatly appreciate it. Leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes or whatever other podcast app you're listening to on also really helps. And hey, if you've got a question, comment, correction, or just want to say hi, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also our Facebook page where you can message us and we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, and Benji Fishman. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.